Teitelbaum. It's really a pleasure to be here. Today we're going to speak about Megillat Esther, and the way the Chachamim have set up the Kriya of Megillat Esther is that we read the Haftarah of Amalek and Shmuel and Shaul right before we read Megillat Esther. And I'd like to do today Megillat Esther within that context. It's very interesting when we learn Megillat Esther. There are so many wonderful lessons to learn. We saw today, as Rabbi Willig really explained, many of the halachot that are connected with Megillat Esther, which is really very enlightening and important. And what I'd like to do is actually kind of the other side and some other hashkafic ideas of Megillat Esther. And what I'd like to do is there's so many lessons. There's the lesson of Hashkacha Pratit, right, how God watches us, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and many times we don't even see it in reality, right? We have to look for it. We have to understand and see Yad Hashem. There's so many different lessons that we could learn from Megillat Esther, but today I'd like to read it in light of the setup, the way Chachamim, Chazal, set up with the Haftarah, and then we read Megillat Esther. So within that context, I'd like to start actually with page 3. I just want to make sure I have the same printouts that everyone else has. Where are the copies? Outside? Okay, I just need one just to see how they printed it out for you. Okay, so this is what I'd like to do today. What I'd like to do is I'd like to understand Megillat Esther within the context of the Haftarah, which means I'd like to see Megillat Esther within the context of global Tanakh. When we learn Tanakh, when we learn the different Sfarim in Tanakh, the question is, what are we trying to see within the Sefer? What is the message that we want to understand? And what I'd like to do today is to read it globally, which means to see the Tanakh as one big unit and to understand what happens with the personalities in Tanakh. How do we see the flow of history in Tanakh and the message that we find in the different understandings of the personalities and of the events that take place? And what I'd like to suggest today is that exactly is the way Chazal want us to read Megillat Esther. Because before we read Megillat Esther, the Haftorah that we read on Shabbat is the story of Shmuel and Amalek. So we must read Megillat Esther within the context of Mechiyat Amalek, within the context of destroying Amalek. And what does that tell us? What does that teach us? And what does that show us in general about the way things work in life, Tanakh, history, and really try to connect it to our lives today? So in your printouts, right, we're going to start with number 12, which is on page 3. Shmuel Aleph Perek Tet. So we're going to do a little bit of a background of Shmuel and of Shaul HaMelech. In order to understand, to read Megillat Esther, this is a little unusual that we're going to do it, but this is really the way that the Chachamim want us to read Megillat Esther. So where does Shaul come from? Shaul is Melech on Yisrael, and he comes from Shevet Binyamin. We see his lineage. Vayhi ish mi Binyamin, ushmo Kish ben Aviel ben Tzror. So Shaul comes from Shevet Binyamin. His father is Kish. And what we see in number 13, Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud, is that Shaul is modest. When he is anointed to be king, he hides. He doesn't want to be arrogant. He has a certain tzniut. He has a certain modesty. And we look for Shaul and we can't find him. So one of the personality traits we have of Shaul is modesty. And when people criticize Shaul, if he doesn't act the way everyone wants to, he is kemacharish. He is quiet. He makes himself as if he's deaf. So we have certain personality traits of Shaul, right? He comes from Shevet Binyamin. He is from Binyamin. We see that he has a certain modesty to him. He's not an arrogant leader. He has Shmuel as his advisor. And one of the first mitzvot that Shaul has to accomplish as Melech is destroying Amalek. And we totally understand why Nechiyat Amalek, destroying Amalek, is connected with Megillat Esther, because Haman is Ha'agagi. He is from Amalek. So we see a parallel between the two. So what I'd like to do is to see the story of Shaul first, and his destroying Amalek, and then to read Megillat Esther. So now we're in, I have to go quite to your printout. We are on number 14, even though the heading is on page 3. The whole perek is really on page 4. So in Shmuel, Aleph, Perek, Tet, Vav. So what is it about Amalek and Shaul? In Pasuk Gimel, what is the mitzvah that Shaul has to achieve with Amalek? Shmuel, who is the Navi at the time, tells him that you have to listen l'kol divrei Hashem. You have to listen to what Hashem said. And what is it that you have to do? Pasuk Gimel, atalech v'hikitat Amalek. You have to destroy Amalek. And you have to destroy everything that they have and not have compassion. And we know this is very unusual for Am Yisrael. How do we always identify the Jews? We're compassionate, we care, we're moral and ethical, right? And what is the depiction here? Lo tachmol alav. Vehemata, and you have to kill, me'ish v'ad isha, me'olel v'ad yonek, mishor v'ad se, migamal ad chamor. You have to kill all the women and the children, the men, all of the animals. This is very difficult, right? It's a very difficult mitzvah. But when Shaul is anointed as king, he knows that he has to do this mitzvah. Because what are the three mitzvot that Bnei Yisrael have to do when they come into Eretz Yisrael? Number one, they have to appoint a king. Number two, they have to destroy Amalek. And number three, they have to build Bet HaMikdash. Those are the two mitzvot, the three mitzvot that Bnei Yisrael have. So now that Shaul is anointed, he knows that this is his obligation. Where else do we see the halacha of destroying Amalek? We have it in Shmot. And we have it also in Dvarim. When we read the Haftara of destroying Amalek, it's really precedented by the idea of the Maftir, which is in Dvarim. So we know that we have already a tradition, right? We know that this is a mitzvah. No matter how difficult it is, we have this specific mitzvah, and Shaul knows that he has to fulfill it as Melech. So what happens? Shaul comes, and he's about to fight, and we find that he is unsure. In Pasuk Hey, right, Shaul comes, Vayirev Banachal, and he's waiting in the Nachal. The question is, what does that mean? According to the Pshat, he's just setting up his tactics in order to attack Amalek. But what we see, the way Rashi explains it, look at number 15, the way Rashi explains it is that his conscience is hurting him. He's really worried. On the one hand, we're supposed to be compassionate, we're supposed to be caring, and here we have to destroy an entire nation. We have the halacha of Egla Arufa. And what's the halacha of Egla Arufa? Right? When you find a dead body in the field and you don't know who it is. So you measure what city is closest, and all the elders of the city have to come out, wash their hands, and they have to say that they didn't kill this individual. Which means they have to make an announcement, the elders of the city have to make an announcement that they're not responsible. What do we know? We know, of course, that the elders of the city did not kill this individual. But they are responsible for the community. So if we care about even one person, and we have this whole ceremony that we do in order to make sure that we identify or care about this person, or this thing should never happen again, so how can you have Bnei Israel go out and kill an entire nation? The women, the children, everybody. So Shaul really had difficulty understanding the moral and ethical implications of this act, of this mitzvah. Now the question is, what should Shaul have done if he really had this moral and ethical issue? He should have gone back to Shmuel. He should have asked him, so what do I really do? Is this really the mitzvah of Hashem? Explain it to me. But what does Shaul do? Shaul goes out and Patsuk Zayin, Vayach Shaul et Amalek, Mechavila Boachashur, Asher al Pnei Mitzrayim. We're back in our perek. Shaul kills the entire nation, the women, the children, everybody, but what does he take? Patsuk Chet, he saves Agag, and he leaves the king, Melech Agag, alive, and he destroys the entire nation. Kol ha'am hechrin l'sicharet. And not only that, what does he do? Vayachmol Shaul va'am, Pasuk Tet, he has compassion on Agag, on the king, va'al meitav atzon, and on the possessions. What was the rule? He had to kill everybody, and he also should not take from the possessions. Why? Because this is a religious war. Which means the idea of Amalek is not just a regular war. And if you take the possessions, and if you take the booty, what does it seem like? That you really did this war in order to get money. You did it in order to really have a political victory. You did it in order to increase your finances, which means it's not really a moral and ethical war. It's not really on a high level. It doesn't really represent something bigger than it is. It isn't finishing the circle of something that happened many years ago. It's plain. It's just to make money. It's just a regular war. And the whole idea of Amalek is to show that it's something unusual, even something difficult for Am Yisrael, that we didn't really do these kind of wars. So by his catching Agag, the king of Amalek, and by his taking the possessions, then we see that something is wrong here. Shaul is really not living up to his job in destroying Amalek. And in Pasuk Yud Aleph, right, Hashem is very upset. And Hashem tells Shmuel, right, the Navi at the time, and Shmuel is upset, Vayazek el Hashem kol alayla, right? And Shmuel is crying to Hashem all night. Why? Because he was sent to destroy Amalek, and instead, what did he do? He took from the Shalal, and he left Melech Agag alive. And as a result, what do we see in the end of the Perek? Number one, we see that Shaul loses his melucha. Why does he lose his kingship, his melucha? Because he didn't destroy Amalek, right? Shaul was a good king, right? He won many battles. He unified Am Yisrael. He was very successful in starting the whole idea of kingship. But because, number one, earlier on in Sefer Shmuel, he brings the Korban early and he doesn't listen exactly to Dvar Hashem. And he doesn't listen to Dvar Hashem here, we see that Shaul fails in his job as Melech, because he doesn't listen to Dvar Hashem. And not only that, by keeping Melech Agag alive, he doesn't fulfill the idea of destroying Amalek and who represents Amalek. And number two, by taking from the Bizah, by taking from the booty, he's showing that it's really a mundane war. It's not about the religious principles. It's really just an everyday war. We did it for regular circumstances and regular impulses. As a result, Shaul loses his lucha. So the question is, of course, we can make the connection between Amalek and Haman. Haman is an Agagi. We see Agag is Melech Amalek. So is that the only connection that we have between Haman, the story of Mordechai and Esther, and Shaul? Meaning, is that the only reason that we have Shaul and Nechiyat Amalek as the Haftarah? And then we read Megillat Esther, which means Amalek, that's our connection, and that's enough of an understanding of why this was chosen as the Haftarah. What I'd like to propose today, and we see it in light of Chazal, is that Tanakh really has to be seen globally in what way? Which means in certain generations we see that individuals do things, and later generations have to really fix it up, or do a tikkun, as we call it. And we find this throughout Tanakh. We find in Sefer Bereshit, for example, right, that Yehuda is chosen to be king, right? He is given melucha, lo yasur shevet miYehuda, but it takes entire Sfarim and Tanakh until we find someone who is really has the qualifications to be that melech. But we were promised in Sefer Bereshit, boom, so in Sefer Shemot we should already have someone from Shevet Yehuda who stands up. But you have to earn it. In Tanakh, you have to earn it. On the other hand, we have situations in Tanakh where we have the story of Lot. Lot is the epitome of going part of the way. Lot goes part of the way with Abraham, and what's the symbolism of Lot? Right? Hiparedna me'alai. You have to separate from me. So the whole symbolism of Lot is separation from Abraham. And yet, is there going to be anyone in Tanakh who's going to do the tikkun, who's going to fix that separation later on, farim later, hundreds of years later? It's going to be Rut. The whole idea of Rut and Am Yisrael, the whole idea of Rut is the language, the Rut of Kaaba. Rut cleaves onto Naomi. And yet, her sister-in-law Orpah, what does she do? She turns away. She goes part of the way, and she turns away. Which means we have choices in Tanakh. We have choices in our lives. Do we continue exactly the way our parents taught us? In some things we should. We should continue that tradition. On the other hand, there are certain things that we have to see and we have to rectify. We have to do tikkunim. So what we're going to see in Megillat Esther is not only that we should read Megillat Esther with the connection of Amalek, but we also have to read it within a bigger picture. We also have to read it within the bigger picture of tikkunim and of really rectifying things in Tanakh. And very interestingly, that's the way Chazal wants to read it as well. So we're going to just see a few Gemaras, and then we're going to read Megillat Esther in that light. So please look at, it should be number 7 on page 3. And we're just going to do these three Gemaras. We're on page 3. It should be number 7. The one that comes before 8, the 7 didn't come out. And it wants to discuss, and we're just going to do the last part, how should you read or how should you understand Mordechai? Within what context? Look at the last two lines of Gemara Bavli, Masechet Megillah Daf Yud Bet Amud Bet. What does it say there? Umashi lem liyimini. How should we understand Mordechai and Shevet Binyamin within the context of Megillat Esther? This is Masechet Megillah, and a lot of the Parshanut that we have on Megillah is within these Dapim in the Gemara. De lokatle Shaul la'agag. Which means one way that we have to read entire Megillat Esther is within the context that Shaul did not destroy Agag. Which means one of the ways that we have to read Megillat Esther is with that in mind. Not just the idea of Mechiyat Amalek, Mechiyat Amalek, Amalek, Amalek. But that Shaul did not destroy Agag. And how does that play out in Tanakh? How does that play out in the life of Mordechai? Not only that, we're going to look further down in the next Gemara, number 8. Masechet Megillah Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. Here it wants to describe, how do we see the individuals in Tanakh? How do we see Shaul? Is Shaul a standalone, or does he come from an entire history? And Shaul comes from an entire history of Rachel. In another Gemara we have Binyamin. And the whole identity of Rachel, of Binyamin, and of Shaul, and of Esther is a certain kind of tzniut. Is a certain kind of quietness, a certain kind of modesty, a certain kind of standing back from the involvement in what's going on. So the question is, that's a good quality. We many times speak about tzniut and being quiet as a good quality. But the question is, does that have any limits? And is that to be used in all situations? Or sometimes you have to use your tzniut, and sometimes you have to really make a stand. Which means this tzniut of Shaul, is it a blanket? A blank check that you can use it all the time? Is this a blanket statement that every time something should happen, Shaul should always use tzniut? He should always stand back. He should not make a stand. Every time Rachel has an issue, she should always be in the background. What we see in Tanakh also is that many times we have individuals who start quiet, who start, in a sense, in the background, and really are passive, and then they take a stand. Which means, did we expect Shaul, even though he was quiet and he was modest, do we expect him at one point to really take a stand? To really stand up and do exactly Dvar Hashem with Amalek? Should he have really realized that he should be self-confident in Dvar Hashem and really take a stand and really do Dvar Hashem to the letter? Not say, you know, I have questions. I'm really not out there. I'm really not self-confident. I shouldn't really fulfill Dvar Hashem and be Hashem's representative. Many times that's what required with us in life. Sometimes, right, we could be laid back, we can stand back, let other people take care of things, but sometimes it's our responsibility. And it doesn't mean that we have to be born that way. What we see in Tanakh in general is we have a lot of individuals who start out quiet, who start out meek, who start out really as passive individuals, and then really take a stand. A great example is Chana. Chana in the beginning, totally Chana, right? Relies on her husband with tefillah, with Korbanot, because he is the man of the family, he's the one who davens, he's the one who's a public figure, so she relies on him to really solve all the problems and to really be the liaison between her and Hashem. But what Elkanah, right, can't understand is the depth of Chana's need. And in the end, Chana had to stand up for herself. And to make the connection to us, we see the idea with what we're doing is the idea with Rachel. Rachel also was relying on Yaakov to be her liaison with Hashem. And in the end, at one point, Yaakov tells her, I can't do this for you. You have to stand up for yourself. So we have many times in Tanakh where we have the individual as more of a passive individual and then really takes a stand. And now we're going to get to Megillat Esther. Using all this as a background, I would like now to really read Megillat Esther within this context of Tanakh, within this context of Shaul and Amalek, and within this view of Chazal, that this is the way you have to read Megillat Esther, which means you have to read it within the context of the rest of Tanakh. You have to read it within the context of what's going on in especially the story of Shaul and Amalek. And what I'd like to propose to you is not only are the ideas very similar, but you're going to see that the language in Megillat Esther is written as a direct answer to Shaul and Amalek. So when Chazal really proposed and tell us that we have to read the Haftara of Amalek right before we read Megillat Esther, it's really to give us that message. It's really to see one written within the other. So I'd like to start, and when Esther Perek Bet, yeah, it's on page 2 of your source sheet, and we're starting with Esther. Now we're finally getting into Megillat Esther. We did everything as an introduction, and now we're going to see how all the pieces really fit together. In Esther Perek Bet, we're introduced to Mordechai. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan Abira, u'shmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish ish Yemini. What's fascinating about Mordechai is that right away he has two identities. He's a Yehudi on one hand, and he's a Yemini. On the one hand, we know he's a Yemini. He is from Shevet Binyamin. He is from Shaul's family. He's from Kish, ish Yemini. But on the other hand, whose name is not mentioned here? Shaul. If you want to identify Mordechai, and he's from the Kish family, and he's from Binyamin, and we know Kish is Shaul's father, who would you want to identify him as? Shaul. But why don't we go all the way back to Shaul? Because what does Shaul have on his, I guess, personal record? He has the fact that he did not destroy Amalek, which means Shaul lost the melucha for all of Shevet Binyamin. If it wasn't for Shaul, what would Mordechai be? He might have been Melech Yisrael. He would have been part of the leadership, the melachim of Am Yisrael, because when Shaul loses the melucha, who gets the melucha? It's David. It's Shevet Yehuda. On the other hand, he's identified as a Yehudi. And the Gemara that we read, even though we didn't read that line, says, is it because his mother's from Shevet Yehuda? Is it because B'nai Yehuda can really identify, in a sense, with Mordechai, not only with his personality, but with the idea of what Mordechai stands for? And Pasuk Vav, it explains to us, Asher Hoglam Yerushalayim. Right? So again, we have two identities for Mordechai. Is he really a Yehudi, part of the Jewish people? Is he from Shevet Yehuda? We know he's not from Shevet Yehuda. But does he have the character of Shevet Yehuda? What do we know about Shevet Yehuda? Vayigash alav Yehuda. What do we know about David HaMelech? Vayigash al HaPlishti. When Bnei Israel had issues, David HaMelech steps up. Shevet Yehuda steps up. Does he identify more with Shevet Yehuda? Or does he identify with Shevet Binyamin? Meaning, what is Mordechai? And that's also the idea of Purim. We get dressed up, we have costumes, but what is our identity? And also, Hadassah is identified for us in two ways. She's Hadassah and she's Esther. The whole idea of Megillat Esther is about identity. It's about what do you want to show yourself out to the public. Who are you? What kind of family lineage do you identify with? But what is going to be your identity and how you present yourself to other people? So she's Hadassah and she's Esther. He's Mordechai, but he's Yehudi and he's Ish Yemini. And the question is, what is going to be the definition of Mordechai and Esther by the end of the Megillah? And when we discuss Mordechai and Esther, it's very interesting in the beginning. Asher Hoglam Yerushalayim. Mordechai is in Galut. He is powerless, right? He doesn't have a stake in Bavel, right? They came from Eretz Yisrael. They're part of the Golim, which means we have to see what is Mordechai going to do with the state in Galut. Mordechai, we know later on, when Haman is walking around and he's appointed a second in command, Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai steps up. He is like Shevet Yehuda. He doesn't bow down. He doesn't acquiesce to the power where he is. He stands up and he identifies himself. And yet, what did he tell Esther to do? If you look at all of the beginning of Megillat Esther, and I highlighted some of the words, Esther is always identified in passive terms. Always in passive terms. There's not one active verb about Esther. If you look at Pasuk Chet, right, Vayhi b'Yishama, when they decided, right, that they're going to have a party because they have to replace the queen, Vatilakach Esther. Esther is taken. Pasuk Tet, Vatitav ha'na'ara be'enav, Vatisacheset lefanav. Esther has a certain quality, something unusual about her, but we only know about Esther about how other people relate to her. So we see she has a special quality. She is unusual. There is something special about Esther, but we only find out about it how other people see her and how she affects other people. And in Pasuk Yud, it's very clear. Lo higida Esther et ama vet moladata ki Mordechai tziva alea asher lo tagid. Which means, what does Mordechai tell her? He says, you may not say your nation, you can't say where you were born, because Mordechai commanded her that she should not say. So Esther is quiet. She's Esther, musteret, she is hidden, which means the whole persona of Esther in the beginning is hidden, as opposed to we see the way Mordechai identifies himself. He's a Yehudi, he will stand up to Haman, and he is going to be the public persona of Am Yisrael. And not only that, Pasuk Yud Aleph, every day Mordechai is trying to find out, right, what is happening to Esther, right, Uma Ye'aseba, and what is going to be done to her. So you can't get more of a definition of someone who's passive in Tanakh. Right, over and over, every single pasuk wants to show her passivity, her being a tsnu'ah, her being hidden. similar to the way we defined in the beginning Shaul. He's nechbar lakelim. He's macharish. When they want to appoint him, he hides. He really does not want to take the limelight. Pasuk tedzayin vatilakach Esther. And finally, when she's chosen, she is taken. So we see that Esther is set up, especially by Mordechai, in this position of being quiet, passive, not identifying who she is. And now we know the story of Megillat Esther, right? Mordechai doesn't bow down, and as a result, what does Haman Ha'agagi want to do? And again, Haman is described as Ha'agagi in Sefer and Megillat Esther. He wants to destroy all of Bnei Israel. Now look at the language that is used when he wants to destroy Bnei Israel. We read what Bnei Israel have to do to Amalek. Look at Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Gimel. It's number 2 on the sheets. When they send the messages to everybody to destroy Am Yisrael, it's Lahashmid, Laharog, Ulaabed, we're in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Yud Gimel, et kol hayudim mina'ar ve'ad zaken tat ve'nashim biyom echad, which means everybody's going to be destroyed in one day, the same language that's used with Michiyat Amalek, which means, in a sense, the Tanakh wants to show us that it's a payback. Haman is seeing this, right, as a personal vendetta to get back for what was done to Amalek. And not only that, for Haman he wants to do it just because he was offended, right? And he has no good reason for destroying Am Yisrael. There's no history like we have with Amalek and Bnei Israel, that they wanted to annihilate us. All of Amalek came and wanted to annihilate us in the Midbar, so we have this certain kind of history with them. For Haman, it's personal. Yesh Am Echad, Mefuzar, and Mefarad. They're different, they're unusual, and you know what really bothers me? They wouldn't bow down to me. And because Mordechai doesn't bow down to him, he wants to destroy an entire nation. So we see, on the one hand, even though we have parallels, we also have the difference. They're foils for each other. Haman wants to do it for a personal issue, for no real reason. He doesn't even have a good reason. And not only that, Ushlalam Lavoz, which means Haman says, not only are we going to destroy Bnei Israel, we're also going to take the booty, the shalal. So again, we see the parallels. We're... Shaul was told not to take from the shalal, but he takes from the shalal, from the booty. Here we see what happens with Haman. They're going to kill everybody, women and children, in one day, and they're going to take the shalal, which means this is also not a moral and ethical war. This is just really destroy them, and we're going to get something out of it in the end. And the question is, who is going to really rectify the situation? Is it going to be Esther, or is it going to be Mordechai? Who do we really expect to rectify the situation? We expect Mordechai. He is the leader of Am Yisrael, and he is the one who is really taking a stand. So Mordechai yadat kol asher nasa, we're in Esther Perek Dalet Pasuk Aleph. Mordechai knows that everything is done, and he wears sak va'efer, he publicly is in Avelot, and he goes in the city, vayizak za'aka gedola umara, he cries out to Hashem, right? Or he just cries out. Who cried out earlier when he was so upset when Bnei Israel were not doing Dvar Hashem ba'amalek? We have Shmuel, but earlier on we have in Sefer Breshit, who cries out when he doesn't get the bracha? Esav. And we know that Amalek is from Esav. So again, in the Midrash, I didn't print it out for you here, but the Midrash also makes this connection because Esav cried out and Yaakov was the one who caused it. So that echo and that cry in history comes all the way to Megillat Esther, which means in Tanakh, you always have to tie up loose ends somehow, which means everything that you do has echoes. Everything leaves a mark. There isn't anything that you do in Tanakh that doesn't leave some kind of history, that doesn't leave some kind of echo, that doesn't have to be taken care of by later generations. We're not an island. We are the cumulative history of our parents, of our generations before us. And a lot of what makes us tick is what happened before. And that has an effect on us. And what we see in Tanakh, that really those things come back to root. And somehow, somewhere, everybody really has to rectify or work out or do tikkunim for things that happened in the past. And what I'd like to show here is that we find that very clearly. Mordechai tells Esther that she now has to solve this whole problem. Mordechai, he's the public individual. He was the one who's really set up as the public persona. But now he says, you know what? I put you in the castle to... wait quietly for this moment. And what does he tell her that she has to do? We're now in Perek Dalet Pasuk Chet. Now Mordechai sends a message to Esther because she's in the castle, in the palace. Lahagid la ulitzavot alea, lavo el hamelech litchanen lo ulevakesh milfanav alama. Mordechai says, I put you in the palace and now this is your job. I told you to be quiet, but now you have to act. And what specifically should you do? You have to run to Ahasuerus. You have to throw yourself down at his feet, and you have to beg him for your nation. That is what Mordechai tells Esther to do. I put you in the palace for this moment. You're going to have to beg Achashverosh in order to make sure that Bnei Yisrael are going to be freed. And Esther answers back, I can't just go to the king, right? If I go to the king and I'm not called, right, Pasuk Yud Aleph, we all know that any man or woman who comes to Achashverosh and he's not called, right, is going to be killed. And I wasn't called for 30 days. So the question is Esther just using this as an excuse? Meaning, you told me to be passive. Everything you told me was to be quiet and not say anything, and now you want me to be active? Now all of a sudden I have to turn around and I have to do something that's against my nature, that's against everything that you've educated me till this moment? Right? Can you do that to someone? Right? Or is she really saying the truth is, right, you just can't approach the king. I wasn't called for 30 days, and now all of a sudden out of nowhere, I'm going to appear to the king? So Mordechai answers these words. And the question is, why are these words really so critical to Esther? Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayomer Mordechai lahashiv el Esther. So he answers back to her. Al tidami b'nafshech lihimalet bet hamelech mikol hayudim. Don't think that you can hang out in the palace and you'll separate yourself and save yourself, right, while all the other Jews are going to be destroyed. And again, we have to read this in the context of Tanakh. Where else do we have someone from the house of Shaul in the palace looking out the window? I'll give some hints. Looking out the window while all of Bnei Yisrael are doing something and she sees herself separated from everybody else. Michal. Michal bat Shaul. Michal is the daughter of Shaul. She is in the palace. She is looking out her window to all of Bnei Yisrael bringing the Aron Brit Hashem to Yerushalayim. And who's dancing with them? David HaMelech. David HaMelech is part of Am Yisrael. He's dancing with them. He's singing with them. They're bringing Aron Brit Hashem to Yerushalayim. They're happy. They're excited. And Michal is full of disdain. That's not the way Melech Yisrael behaves, being part of all Am Yisrael. Right? That's not the way we behave in Shaul and Melech's house. In my house, we were proper. Right? We didn't do those kind of things. We didn't behave in that kind of way. And that's not a way Melech should behave. She was very disappointed. And David was horrified. But what's fascinating here is that Mordechai brings that phrase. Do you think you can hide in a castle being separate from everybody? Which means, what do we do with our history? What do we do with our background? What should Esther do with her whole lineage of Shaul and Michal and everything that that stands for? And Mordechai this whole time was prepping her that way. Be quiet, be separate, be tsanua, don't say anything. And he's saying to her now, don't think you can hide in the castle. Don't think you can use this tsanuot or quiet or this passivity now to use it as an excuse that you don't have to step up. Meaning, are there times in life where we really have to step up, where we really have to make a difference, where we really have to take our role and really do something about the future of Am Yisrael or things within family? So what does he tell her? Pasuk Yudalad, ki im ha-charesh ta-charishi ba'et hazot. If you're quiet at this moment, but what words does the Megillah use here? Ha-charesh ta-charishi. If you're going to be quiet. What's the famous phrase we have about Shaul when people were criticizing him? Vayihi ki-ma-charish. Which means Shaul is Maharish. Everyone's criticizing and he's quiet. On the one hand, that's a good quality. But he's saying, if you're going to be quiet now, Revach v'hatzalah yamod layudim imakom acher. Bnei Yisrael are going to be saved. Which means it's not like, oh, if you don't do this, Bnei Yisrael are not going to be saved. They will be saved. But where will it come from? Mimakom acher. Ve'at ubeit avich tovedu. But you and your father's house are going to be destroyed. Who's your father's house? Shaul. This is the chance for Shaul HaMelech to have a tikkun, to be rectified, to really be put on the stage of history that it could actually do a tikkun, really can change its destiny from what it did with Amalek. Which means, what's the big blot on Shaul's record, right? On his permanent record, that he didn't destroy Amalek. That he had a chance as Melech Yisrael to destroy Amalek and he didn't. And what happened as a result? Shaul lost the melucha for him and his entire generations, for all future generations. Mordechai is not a melech as a result, right? At least not from the house of Shaul. Furthermore, what we see here is that Esther has the chance not only to save Bnei Israel, but to also save her family reputation. It's all on her shoulders now, right? She has to be the one to change that entire name and reputation that Bet Shaul has. Can she do it or not? And that's what Mordechai is telling her. Not just you're the only person who could save the Jews. Hashem will do it another way. Right? Yesh lo shluchim harbeh. Hashem could do it many different ways. But this is your chance. And also what's fascinating here is that what we see in Tanakh as well is that not only the men are the ones who see themselves within the stage of history, but we see the women as well, which means we always see that future generation of women, who is the one who does the tikkun for Lot? It's going to be Ruth. Who is the one who does the tikkun for Menashe? That Menashe loves Eretz Yisrael, but all the leaders are really from Ephraim, right? We have Yosef, we have Menashe and Ephraim. Who comes from Menashe to really redeem the name of Shevet Menashe? It's Benot Tzlofchad. It's the daughters of Tzlofchad who come from Shevet Menashe to show the love of Eretz Yisrael. Which means many places in Tanakh we have the women step in. They're also considered continuity. They're also considered from the family. They're also considered. So it's an equal job, which is either the men or the women. It's not one or the other. Everyone has that responsibility. And what we see here is that Esther now has that responsibility. Umi odea im la'et kazot higat la'malchut. And who knows, we're back on Pasuk Yudalad, Perek Dalad, Pasuk Yudalad, who knows if for this reason you achieved Malchut. And why does he use the word Malchut, kingship? Because who really started out the kingship in Am Yisrael? Shaul. And who lost it? Shaul. So this is a way to really bring back the Malchut, the kingship, to the family of Shaul, to Shevet Binyamin in a sense. And it's all on Esther's shoulders. And what does she say? Okay. Her first job, Ted Zion, is Lech Knoset Kol Ayudim. Get everyone together. Right? And you have to fast, and you have to fast, right, for 3 days. What is one of the things that we have a criticism of Shaul? Before he fights Amalek, what kind of war is it? It's a religious war. What would we have expected Shaul to do right before that war, especially if he has moral and ethical qualms? Pray. Fast. Do something spiritual, religious. And what does Esther realize? She realizes before she does this destroying of Amalek, it's a religious battle. It's something that has to be spiritual. It's not just a war. It's not just a battle. And further on, what we see, she says, the kasher avadati avadati. What's our criticism of Shaul? Again, Shaul was a great king, but he had a great failing. After Amalek, when Shmuel approaches him, does he admit right away, I did the wrong thing? Absolutely not. When he said, no, I did the right thing. I just left the God alive and I took from the Bizah, but otherwise I did Dvar Hashem. Which means Shaul does not want to take the consequences for his actions. What does Esther show right away? And again, that's why you have to read the Megillah, really in light of Shaul and Amalek. She says right away, Kasher avadati avadati. I'm willing to take the consequences. Which means, as opposed to Shaul, who doesn't want to take the consequences and doesn't want to believe that, this one mistake really changes the whole future of his whole family and they won't be kings anymore, she realizes why right away. Kasher avadati avadati. And then look at the transformation. Pasuk Yudzayin. Vayavor Mordechai vayat kechol asher tzivta alav Esther. The turnaround to the Megillah. Now Mordechai is listening to what Esther has to say. He gave her this position. He's saying, now you have to act and now take the reins. Till now, he was commanding her. You have to be quiet. You don't have to say anything. But now, when she has to take a step forward, Mordechai is now listening to everything that Esther says because he put her in that position and he accepts now, right, what her plan is going to be. And the question is, what is Esther's plan? Now, what we're going to see very interestingly is Esther's first interest is destroy Haman. Mordechai told her, beg for the Jewish people. But Esther realizes that her first job is to destroy Haman. Why? Because what was the biggest failing that Shaul had when he doesn't destroy Amalek? He leaves Melech Agag alive. So her first job is to destroy Agag, which means she wants to make sure Haman Ha'agagi is going to be destroyed. And her second interest, obviously, is saving Am Yisrael. How does she do this? What is Haman's biggest failing? Haman's biggest failing is what? What would you think Haman's biggest failing is? What? Pride. Arrogance. Which means, what is Haman's role? He wants to reach the top. He starts as a lowly assistant, and he reaches second in command. He gets the ring of the king. When Mordechai doesn't bow down to him, he's offended. How can you not bow down to me? Everyone's bowing down to me. His problem is arrogance. What's Ahasuerus's problem? Jealousy, insecurity. What's the first thing Ahasuerus does when Vashti doesn't listen to him and goes against his rule and his tzivui? Kill her right away. How can you have someone going against what I say? So we see that Ahasuerus's issue is jealousy and Haman's issue is pride. And Esther has a plan that really works exactly in these two areas. What does she realize about Haman? She's going to invite Haman to a private party. Just her and Ahasuerus and Haman. So what will Haman think? This is his journey to the top, right? The queen is even inviting him, right, to dine. On the other hand, for Ahasuerus, what's going to happen when Ahasuerus hears that it's just Haman that's invited to this party. So he's going to become jealous. And not only that, what happens when Ahasuerus can't sleep in the middle of the night? Right? Who is the one who does all these great things for him? Right? Mordechai. Mordechai saves his life. And when Ahasuerus can't sleep, it's the middle of the night, and he wants to know what to do for someone who has helped him, who's in the chatzer? Who's in the courtyard? Haman, in the middle of the night. And not only that, when Ahasuerus wants to know, what should we do to someone who I really want to respect, and he doesn't say who it is, but Haman thinks it's him, what does he ask? What could you give me? What did you give someone who you respect and you want to show honor to? You give him your horse, you give him your clothing, and you give him your crown. That was Haman's suggestion. So what does Ahasuerus think Haman wants? His kingship. He wants his position, which means Esther has really masterminded this entire scenario. So she's masterminding this entire scenario, realizing that instead of her really bringing the downfall of these other people, they will really destroy and implode themselves. And that is the genius of Esther. Instead of doing it outwardly, which was Mordechai's tact, she takes the other tact completely. So she uses this tzniut, she uses this kind of quiet power, but she uses it in a way to affect certain results. And she's very successful. Because when they come to the party, we're in Perek Zion, when they come to the party, why is Ahasuerus so willing, right, to destroy Haman? This is second in command, because Esther has masterminded it in this way. And that's why in Perek Zion Patuk Vav, Vatomer Esther ish tsar v'oyev, when Ahasuerus says, what's with you? What can I do for you? And she says that Haman wants to destroy my entire people. We see that Ahasuerus is very receptive. And what happens as a result is Ahasuerus is so upset, he walks out to his garden. And when he comes in, Haman is throwing himself, right, at Esther, begging her, right, to forgive him. But obviously, when Ahasuerus walks in, right, he is very disturbed. And the first thing that Esther is able to accomplish is what? Is to destroy Haman. So again, midah keneged midah. Esther wants to destroy Haman because he is ha'agagi. He represents what Shaul did not finish. So Esther sees herself within that rubric. But not only that, what was the second thing that Shaul didn't do? Shaul left from the bizah. He left from the booty. Look at Esther Perek Chet, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Look at Esther Perek Chet, Pasuk Yud Aleph. You have it on the same page, on the bottom. And again, when Bnei Israel are able to defend themselves, right, they can't go out on the attack. They have to defend themselves. If they defend themselves, what is the writ that they're allowed to do? Look at Esther Perek Chet, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Bnei Israel can't undo the edict, which means they don't send out an edict saying the non-Jews cannot fight against the Jews. That's out. The only edict that they can send out is that the Jews can fight also against the non-Jews. So when you're attacked, you can defend yourself. And what is the edict that is sent out? The edict that is sent out that Bnei Israel can defend themselves, la'amod al-nasham, but what are they allowed to do? They're allowed la'ashmid, la'harog, u'la'abed et kol chel am umdina ha'tsarim otam, taf the Nashim Ushlalam Lavoz. The Jews were given the permission to destroy everybody, women and children, and take what? And take from the booty. But again, if this is a tikkun for what happens with Shaul and Amalek, if he was really moral and ethical, he wouldn't kill the women and children, right? He wouldn't have done that if that was really what was bothering him. So look at Esther Perek Tet. When Bnei Israel defend themselves, what do? They kill Bishushan Shlosh Me'ot Ish, only the men, only the people who are really fighting against them, not the Nashim and the Taf. Ubabiza lo shalchu et yadam. They don't take from the booty, which means we really see that Megillat Esther and the story of Esther is really written as an exact response, as a type of tikkun for what happened in the time of Shaul. And as a result, Vayichtov Mordechai et hadvarim ha'ele. Right, Mordechai, it's Esther and Mordechai. And the words in the Megillah is Ma'amar Esther kiyam et hadvarim ha'ele. Which means all the things and the Purim and all the halachot that you learned earlier were really established because of Mordechai and Esther. And not only that, Kimu v'kiblu ha'yudim alehem. Bnei Israel accepted the Purim holiday, but also the Midrash says, what does it mean, Kimu v'kiblu ayudim alehem? They accepted Har Sinai, they accepted Torah Shebaal Peh, they accepted things beyond, which means by Mordechai and Esther behaving in this way, right, it was sending a message to Am Yisrael, which means you have to see yourself within the tradition, you have to see yourself within your big history, you have to see yourself working within a bigger stage, and not only just because you're in galut to think that everything is past, everything in the past has nothing to do with you, and now you start a new beginning. We really are a fulfillment of everything that happened in the past, and as a result, right, we see in the end that Mordechai and Esther are really the leaders of Am Yisrael, but in a way that totally responds to things that we saw in the past and what we see especially in the Haftarah. So I'd like to just finish up with the idea of Megillat Esther and this idea of Tikkunim is that when we read the Megillah and we see the way it's written and we see the connection between the past and the present and what happens even in the far past and really how it's going to be moving forward, Kimu v'kiblu alehem, which means the legacy of Megillat Esther is not just for its own time, but they set up these halachot, right, and they set up Purim that we even celebrate till today. So the message, especially the way Chazal want us to understand, the Chachamim and the Gemara, want us to understand reading the Gilad Esther and how we see it really works out in the Pshat, is that this idea of being part of your history and yet being able to make decisions based on that, but of moving in the future, is really one of the messages of Megillat Esther, which means we are what we are our history, we are our family, we are the pieces that make us who we are, right, in the past and our family and our legacy, but on the other hand, we also have a chance to really redefine ourselves and to really make changes and to really affect the future of Am Yisrael. And clearly, Mordechai and Esther are in that position of trying to see their identity. And to come back to our original idea, is that Purim is really all about knowing your identity, who you are, what do you stand for? Is Mordechai a Yehudi, right, or is he Binyamin, or can he really integrate the two? Is Esther Hadassah, or is she Esther? I mean, what is her identity? What is the message that you really want to give forth? How will you identify yourself and really set forth? So the idea of Purim is really fascinating because we do get dressed up. We do wear costumes. We do many times show ourselves in different ways and really put on different identities and different costumes, right? Or really trying to project ourselves in a certain way. But really Purim is all about really trying to define who we are. What is the message? What is the identity that we really want to continue for Kimu v'Kiblu? What would be our legacy for the future generation? So many of us find ourselves that we are in the position of Mordechai and Esther. We are the leaders now, right, or the individuals in that age bracket that make the decisions that affect the future of Am Yisrael. So Purim is not such a frivolous holiday, but it's really a holiday, a really yom, right, of Mishloach Manos, of caring about community, of really making your identity, of really setting, so what is going to be your message to the Jewish community? What is going to be your identity for the family, and what is going to be the legacy that you want to leave for future generations? Purim Sameach.